Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, when we're interested in a topic, we might look it up in an encyclopedia, or more likely these days, Google it. Maybe we'll seek out a book on the subject. When author Mark Kurlansky gets interested enough in something, he writes that book. Kurlansky has some famous one-word book titles, Cod and Salt were two. He tells the story here of when Walter Cronkite cheekily called him, quote, the leading expander of minutiae. Kurlansky can take the jab. He's made a success of finding the many threads of history that lead to and from a seemingly singular thing. Kurlansky's latest book is Paper, Paging Through History. He talked about it at Town Hall Seattle on May 27th. We're presenting the core of his talk here. You can hear the full program, including questions and answers, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
Thank you. People are always coming up to me and offering me book ideas. I got a book idea for you. Often it's pepper. You know, I did salt, I ought to do pepper. Sometimes it's something unpredictable. What about the history of lettuce, you know? The more obscure, the better, is sort of the idea. When I was working on my book about the year 1968, I interviewed Walter Cronkite, who lived across town from me in Manhattan. And I went to his apartment, and he answered the door himself. And I sort of paused for a moment because, you know, there was this guy who had given me news my whole childhood. and in that very familiar and distinct voice, he suddenly said, "Why, I know you. You're the leading expander of minutiae." That's actually not what I'm trying to do. I think of myself primarily as a storyteller, both fiction and nonfiction. I look for things that are good stories. I don't try to be weirdly obscure. Maybe I am sometimes, but I don't realize it, because to me, they're things that seem important. So a guy contacted me named Kermit Hummel, odd name. He ran a small publishing house in Vermont that was acquired by Norton, and he said, "You know, you ought to do a book about paper." Kermit's the only one who's ever talked me into their idea. We talked about it a lot. He was a very interesting guy. He gave me some books to read. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that it really was a good idea. I thought the timing was right. I thought it was a good story. And I liked the way it seemed to have a beginning and an end. Because the problem with history is that history doesn't have a beginning or an end. Everything just sort of flows. But books have a beginning and an end. So you have to figure out where to begin and where to end. And the story of paper actually had a beginning. A guy named Cai Lun, who was a eunuch in the Han court of China in the first century AD. And every school kid in China learns that Cai Lun invented paper, and his portrait is everywhere in China. The only problem is that archaeologists have gone to China and found pieces of paper that were 100 and 200 years before Cai Lun was born. And the idea that paper had an ending, which I thought, you know, be a good time to write about paper now that it's, after 2,000 years, about to disappear, Well, it's not about to disappear. It's not anywhere close to disappearing. So all my basic premises were wrong. And working on this book really changed my thinking a lot about technology and history and the way they interact. For one thing, I came to realize this popular idea that new technology replaces old technology really isn't true. I mean, it happens sometimes, but very rarely. You know, television was supposed to replace radio. Vinyl record sales are going up and up every year. Did you know that British laws are written on vellum, which is high-quality parchment? You know, they have been for as long as the British have been writing laws, and it's this very old European idea that you can't really count on paper. If something's really important, you should put it on parchment. So a member of parliament recently said, you know, we could just print these laws on paper and we'd save a lot of money. People got very upset. You know, things stick around. And, you know, and things come back, too. You know, we've invented all these great alphabets with phonetic characters so that we can say anything. And it seems to me fairly suddenly in recent years we're back with pictographs and hieroglyphics. I mean, what is an emoji? And I came to understand that we were looking at this whole technology thing wrong. It's what I call the technological fallacy. The technological fallacy is the idea that technology changes society. Actually, society changes for lots of reasons, economic, political, cultural, and as it changes, it calls up technology to facilitate these changes. Just to give a really simple example, around 250 BC in China, a guy named Meng Chen invented a camel hair brush. Now, the Chinese were doing a lot of writing and were, as they still are, very into the art of writing, calligraphy. And they were doing watercolors. And they were doing all these things with a wooden stylus. And so this guy, Meng Chen, who, by the way, is the one who built the original Great Wall of China, came up with this idea of a hairbrush. But, you know, it's not like the Chinese started doing calligraphy and writing and watercolors and all these things because now they had a brush. They got a brush because they were doing these things and they needed a better tool for doing it. And that's how it usually works. Famous essay by Martin Heidegger called The Question Concerning Technology. He said, technology is a means to an end. We have an end, we have a goal in mind, and we look to technology to help us achieve those goals. I think it's useful to look at the Luddites, by which I don't mean your neighbor who refuses to use a cell phone, but, you know, the original Luddites who, strangely, we don't really know why they're called Luddites. There was this story of a guy named Ludd, and I was almost believing that story until they started saying that he lived in Sherwood Forest. And I thought, wait a minute. Anyway, for whatever reason, they were called Luddites. They were weavers in the British Midlands. In the 1790s, a Frenchman named Jacquard built a loom. I mean, think about this, 1790s. He created a loom that was programmable with punch cards and could do all sorts of complicated weaves through punch cards. And he did this not because he wanted to advance technology. He did this because he wanted to crush the weavers, who had, you know, good salaries and lots of benefits because they were highly skilled workers and very needed. And the point was not lost on the British weavers, who started smashing the looms. And the British army tried to stop them. It became a capital offense to smash a loom. It got very violent, and the Luddites lost. And some years later, Karl Marx, in writing his definitive work, Das Kapital, wrote about the Luddites. And he said something very important. He said, the reason the Luddites failed was because they attacked the technology, whereas what they needed to do was attack the society, because it was the society that was creating the looms. When I looked at paper and I looked at the history of paper, I could see all this very clearly. Technology arriving when it's needed. You know, paper making at whatever time, we don't know when, but it was invented in China. And it's incredible. You know, what it is cellulose fibers, very common sugar compound that forms fibers in most plants. It's in lots of things. It's in grass, it's in wood, it's in bamboo, in straw, in cotton and silk. And you take anything that has cellulose fibers, and if you can beat it down to the fibers, mix the fibers with water, so it's only like about 2% fibers and the rest water. So it just looks like water, like maybe slightly cloudy water. And you have a screen, you know, originally a little box-like thing, screen. You pour this water solution on the screen, the water falls through, and a film forms on the screen, and you can peel it off and dry it and write on it. I mean, I can't imagine how somebody ever thought of that, but they did. And they did because China was this society where people wrote a lot, people read a lot. There was a bureaucracy that put out lots of information and annals and history, and they were trying to republish the philosophers like Confucius, who had been suppressed under the previous dynasties and had only been written in carved in stone, you know, which is really good for durability, not so good for mobility. But they, you know, they were doing all of these things, and they needed something better than stone, better than bones, better than tortoise shell or bamboo or silk, which in that order were the writing materials they had. So they came up with paper. And they taught their culture to the Koreans, not paper making, but their culture, their language, and love of calligraphy and all these things. And soon the Koreans wanted to make paper also. And the same thing happened to Japan. And for many centuries, paper was a uniquely Asian thing. And then in the Middle Ages, the Arabs developed this extremely literate society, lots of books, and mathematics, and science, and they wrote a lot of poetry, and they even did cookbooks, and they needed a good writing material, something better than papyrus or parchment. And so the thing is, the Chinese were the only ones that invented this. Ever after, it was there if you wanted it, if you needed it, and people would adopt it when they needed it. And the Arabs, in this huge empire that went from Central Asia to the Atlantic, from the Pyrenees to the Sahara, with books everywhere and paper mills everywhere. But the Europeans wouldn't use paper. They knew about paper because the Arabs tried to sell it to them, did sell a little bit to them. But Europe was a society that didn't write a lot, people didn't read a lot. Monks wrote and read. And so there were a few books in monasteries, and they were very beautifully handwritten on parchment. Parchment is not really very practical stuff if you're going to do a lot of books, because you know you need hundreds of animals. You know, it's animal hide, so you need hundreds of animals to do a book. Not sure how many, depends on the size of the book. I checked the Jewish Torah is still done on parchment, and I checked with a Torah maker in Israel, and he told me that it took him about 60 calves to make a Torah, which is smaller than most books. And this was fine. Parchment was fine because, you know, they didn't have a lot of use for paper. And paper was made from rags, and, you know, they would write about... there was a lot of anti-Semitism in this, you know. It was like they would say, you know, the Jews and the Muslims are doing this disgusting stuff, writing on old clothes. And then Europe started to become a much more literate society. A lot more people learned to read and to write. A lot more books. There hadn't been many books in Europe. You know, the Vatican wanted to have a great library. They had about 500 books. You know, the Arabs, like in Cordoba, had hundreds of thousands of books in a library. And several libraries in the Arab world with hundreds of thousands of books. But, you know, Europe started changing, and they needed paper also. It was there when they needed it, and they starting with the Italians in the mid-1200s started making paper. Paper making never crossed the Alps until Nuremberg in 1390. But eventually, Europe also became a paper society. And, you know, paper was, the society was changing, and paper was the tool that would help this happen. You know, art on paper, which was a very old Asian idea, ancient China, but in Europe there was no affordable art until the Renaissance, when they started having paper. You know, they had people like Albrecht Dürer's woodcuts, and drawings became an art form for the first time because there was this kind of democratizing going on in Europe, and artists wanted to reach other classes and not just do art for the church and nobility, and paper was the perfect solution. Leonardo da Vinci, in his lifetime, did 15 paintings, most of which he never finished. Leonardo da Vinci was famous for not finishing things. He was commissioned to do a painting by the Pope, and the Pope asked him how it was coming along, and he said, "I'm experimenting with new varnishes," you know, which is the last thing you do. And they said, "This guy can never finish things because he does the end before the beginning." But, you know, he left behind these 15 paintings in various stages, and he also left behind 4,000 drawings. Paper ever after became, you know, art that was affordable. Books were originally huge. I mean, this podium is not actually big enough for a medieval book. The 14th century poet Petrarch dropped a book in his lap and injured himself so badly he almost had to have a leg amputated. And he started trying to see if people could make some smaller books because books became something that people actually read and, you know, even traveled with and moved around the house with and stuff. And they had to make them a little more portable. The printing press is another perfect example of how ideas come along when you need them. The Chinese invented the printing press and invented movable type. You know, the Chinese famously claimed their great contribution to civilization was four inventions: paper, printing, gunpowder, and compasses. Interesting, paper is the only one that they ascribe to an inventor. They started doing printing presses because of Buddhism. You know, if a Jewish person is extremely devout, they will read the religious books over and over again. And a devout Muslim is supposed to memorize the Quran word for word. But a devout Buddhist is supposed to reproduce a copy of a sutra, which is a book of sermons of the Buddha. And so you make a sutra, and that gets you a blessing. So, can you imagine how many blessings you could get if you had a printing press? and that's how it started. It never really took off there because, you know, movable type is kind of problematic if you have a language that has hundreds of thousands of characters. It was never used in Europe until the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation was a basically political movement that depended on paper. You know, this business of tacking things on church doors and on palaces and pamphlets and books and just a lot more stuff than they could get done by handwriting. And so the printing press was developed to move the Reformation. And it kind of became a model for political activism. And it's just how the American Revolution was done with pamphlets and broadsides and books and the French Revolution. During the French Revolution, the number of books published in France doubled. All political movements. In the 1960s, it was all, you know, it was about putting out printed material. Some of you look like me. You're old enough to remember mimeograph machines. It was needed, and so it was invented. But I'm saying this like it's all just this kind of neat and logical progression. Like Hegel, the German philosopher, said, "Reason is the law of the world, and therefore, in world history, things have come about rationally." Well, I think they come about more chaotically. Holland, England, and America are all examples of countries that printed long before they made paper. It's a lot harder to make paper than to print. You know, you can get a printing press and put it in a back room. And a paper mill, it was water-powered. It needed to be by fast-running water. It had to be the right kind of water. If the water had too much iron in it, the paper would be funny-colored. Just much more difficult. But the problem of, you know, creating printing presses without paper mills is kind of obvious. When the Pilgrims came to Massachusetts, they didn't bring any paper, anybody who knew how to make paper, any printers or any printing press. But this shouldn't surprise you because they also didn't bring any farmers or fishermen or fishing tackle or farming equipment. And the Pilgrims were not prepared. In 1638, a wealthy Puritan decided to establish himself in Massachusetts and he brought a printing press and two printing apprentices. He died on the ship on the way over, but the two apprentices set up the press and printed the first book in America, which was an almanac for the year 1639. No copies of this almanac have survived. So the second book, which was a book of Psalms called the Bay Psalm Book, is famously known as the first book in America, although it's actually the second book. But I guess it's important to call it the first book because a copy just sold in 2013 at Sotheby's for $14 million as the first book in America. So look through your book, see what you have, you know. The first Bible printed in America in 1660 was printed in Algonquin. And, you know, the problem with this is that Algonquins didn't read or write. And so the pilgrims invented a written Algonquin language so that they could teach them the Bible. But then they had to teach them their language, which, you know, you can understand that the Algonquins were a little suspicious about exactly what's going down here. The first Bible printed in English didn't come until 100 years later. And Massachusetts didn't get its first paper mill until 1728. So it's more than 100 years after the pilgrims landed. It was funded by the family of John Hancock. The paper industry in America largely grew up in Pennsylvania to a great degree with the backing of Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin started at least 18 paper mills, a lot of printing presses, a bunch of newspapers, and really you could say was the first American press baron. In 1764, the Stamp Act, remember the Stamp Act? I mean, what the Stamp Act was, is it was a tax on things that were printed. Newspapers, business accounts, playing cards, anything printed. And one of the things that this accomplished was it made all newspaper people hate the British. probably not a good move. And newspapers started calling for their newspapers to be made exclusively with American paper and not use British paper, but there wasn't enough American paper being made. When war broke out, the Revolution, a tremendous paper shortages, which was really a problem because, you know, they used these black powder muskets. And, you know, with the black powder musket, you have to have some paper separating the powder from the ball so that it has a confined explosion so it'll propel the ball. So they needed paper for this. They would break into printing presses and get paper. They broke into one of Franklin's mills and found a huge stack of a sermon on defensive war. The reverend who commissioned it never paid up, and so Franklin never distributed it, so they fired it all at the British. They also fired 3,000 copies of a German Bible. They were trying in the Revolution to boycott everything British. You know, John Adams had that idea later expressed by Mohandas Gandhi that, you know, a revolutionary should wear homespun cloth and not buy textiles from the British Midlands and all of that. But paper was a problem. When the Declaration of Independence came along, first of all, immediately they had that old European idea, you know, that this is too important for paper. So they did it on parchment. Did four copies on parchment. And by the way, you know, passed it around over weeks. You know, this scene in the room where everybody walks up and signs the thing and John Hancock says, there, the British can read that. complete myth. But they wanted people to read the Declaration of Independence. They wanted it to be read by every garrison of the Continental Army, for one thing, and they wanted it to be read all over the colonies. So they printed it on paper, too, broadsides, the Declaration of Independence, on British paper. It's a little worse than that. It was Dutch paper that the Dutch made for the British to use in the colonies. And the Dutch, wanting to please their customer, the British, made this paper with a watermark of the British Royal Seal. So, you know, like the Federalist Papers or Hamilton and those people are arguing for the ratification of the Constitution, you know, the paper has the British Royal Seal on it. Into the 19th century, official documents, the stationery of U.S. senators, had the British Royal Seal on it. Finally, people started saying, what is this? And the government started subsidizing and helping the American paper industry so they could stop using this British stuff. So that's what I mean when I question Hegel about how rationally it all worked. But technology is driven by need, and you know, more reading meant more printing, which required more paper. Paper making increased in the 1790s when a Frenchman, just same country, same time as Jacquard and the loom, a guy named Robert, used the two basic ideas of the Industrial Revolution, steam power instead of water power, and a conveyor belt. So when you made paper, you know, everybody made paper basically the way the ancient Chinese did with this screen. And Robert came up with the idea of making the screen a conveyor belt. And then you could have this continuous roll of paper rather than doing it one sheet at a time. And he did this for the exact same reason that Jacquard did the loom, because paper makers were highly skilled and had lots of privileges, and he wanted to crush them. Paper makers in France demanded certain dishes for certain holidays. They were called modes, and if you owned a paper mill and you didn't give the workers their modes, you would be in a lot of trouble. They had to have pig ears for Mardi Gras, and they had to have donuts for Palm Sunday, and this guy Robert, he just hated these guys, and this was the machine to destroy them. And it didn't completely destroy them, but it did make inroads, and a lot more paper was being made with these machines. But they were still being made with rags, and that was the great limitation, getting enough rags to make all the paper that was needed for everything that people wanted to print. In the American Revolution, it was said to be everyone's patriotic duty to save rags so they could make paper. And paper makers just always struggled. In America, they spent a lot of money importing rags, and a lot of countries passed laws banning the export of rags because they didn't want competing paper producers to get their rags. This book of mine is printed on really nice paper. You know, we had a meeting. We said, come on, you know, there's going to be a book on paper. It's got to be nice paper. So we got really nice paper. It's made by a mill in Pennsylvania called Glatfelter, which started in 1863. They bought the mill at a bargain price and a going out of business sale because the previous owner had gone onto the nearby battlefield at Gettysburg and stripped the dead of bandages and uniforms to make paper. And turned out to be bad for business. People didn't really want that paper. But it was not unprecedented in Europe during the Napoleonic Wars. It wasn't uncommon for papermakers to go on battlefields and strip the dead for rags. That's, you know, pretty well documented. Less verifiable is that it's often said that when Egyptians switched from papyrus to paper in the Middle Ages, that they would break into tombs and take the shrouds off mummies to make paper. The rags were just always a problem. And so they started making wood out of paper. First wood pulp paper in America was made actually the year of Gettysburg, 1863. And it's a classic example of something else that happens in technology. Technology becomes less expensive, more accessible, and lower quality. Happens all the time. And, you know, the truth is that our paper, our wood pulp-based paper, is not nearly the quality of the old rag paper. You go back and you look at old books and you'll see. I've gone and looked at books printed in Venice in 1501 by Aldus Manutius, the inventor of italic type. And, you know, these 500-year-old books, there's no foxing, there's no discoloration. The pages are perfectly white. They're smooth. They aren't wrinkled. I guarantee you our books aren't going to look like that in 500 years. but what it meant was that you had material to make all the paper you wanted to make. And in 1873, for the first time, the U.S. became the world's largest paper maker. of course, they were laying waste to whole virgin forests to make paper. Somebody, I was talking, and it was in Washington, D.C., and somebody asked me a good question. They said, why is it that when they made parchment, nobody got upset about killing all the animals, but then when they made paper, everybody got upset about killing the trees? I don't have a good answer for that, but they did get upset about the trees. And the thing that you should realize is that the problem was solved, that paper does not destroy forests anymore, by and large. Occasionally, there was an issue with Indonesia some years ago, but they've stopped there, too. Paper is made from tree farms that are very sustainable and raise fast-growing trees for the purpose of making paper. So this whole thing about save a tree, you know, when some company sends you a thing and tries to convince you to get your billing electronically to save a tree, doesn't save a tree. It saves them a stamp. There are some environmental issues still with paper mills, but it's not about trees. Some issues about pollution and the kind of energy they use, because it takes a lot of energy to make paper. There again, about new technology, eliminating old technology, a lot less handmade paper is made, but still a considerable amount of handmade paper is made. There's this weird story that I really like. You know, the Japanese make incredible handmade paper. It's very thin, so it's very lightweight, but it has long fibers, so it's strong. And in the 1940s, while the Americans were developing atom bombs to drop on Japanese cities, the Japanese were developing handmade paper balloons to drop bombs on the U.S. And they released 9,000 bombs with handmade paper balloons. And these balloons drifted across the Pacific. 1,000 of them made it to the U.S. They got as far as the farthest one we know of made it to Michigan. People would see them. I was talking in Boston last week. I met somebody who, as a child, actually saw one of these balloons. You know, you'd be out fishing or something, and this weird thing would go floating by. You'd go over the next rise, and then there'd be this boom. It caused 2 brush fires, and the only people it ever killed were in Oregon. 6 people died because a balloon landed and the bomb failed to explode, and these people went over and started messing around with the bomb, and then it blew up. Here's the thing that's different about those times and now. The War Department said to the press, you know, this could cause a real panic, which was the whole idea of the Japanese doing this. So don't report on this. And they didn't write a word about it. Nothing was ever written about this until years, a military historian, years after the war. But, you know, that's an example of an old technology hanging on. Let's bomb them with handmade paper. But the thing that you find over and over again is that when the time is right for an idea, lots of people start working on it. Lots of people started working on computers at about the same time. When Alexander Graham Bell was working on a telephone, a whole bunch of people were working on telephones. An Italian guy in Havana invented a telephone before Alexander Graham Bell. Lots of people were working on electric lights, light bulbs, when Edison was. There was a guy named Farkas Bolyai, a 19th century Hungarian mathematician, that said about new ideas, when the time is right, these things appear in different places, like the way violets come to light in early spring. And then we don't really remember the inventor. Like Kai Lin, who we remember as the inventor, turns out he wasn't the inventor. I started to become aware of this in some of my earlier books, like my book about oysters in New York, and I was writing about the character of Robert Fulton, the inventor of the steamboat. He didn't invent the steamboat. All Robert Fulton did was he established the first steamboat line that made money. It was between the East River of Manhattan and Albany, and it was very profitable, and it showed that, you know, this was a good commercial idea. Those are the people we remember. I wrote a book about Clarence Birdseye, the inventor of frozen food. Didn't invent frozen food. He invented a process that made it commercially viable. We always remember those people. You know, we don't remember the people in Asia who invented printing and movable type. We remember Gutenberg, because Gutenberg showed the Western world that printing could be readable, and it could even be attractive, and that it was a commercially viable idea. Steve Jobs wasn't an inventor. He didn't invent anything. We remember these people. It helps if they made a lot of money, you know. We like to remember people who made a lot of money. Gutenberg didn't make a lot of money. He died very poor. But we remember the people who took the technology and brought it to the society and showed how it would work for something we were trying to do. Computers. An idea that had a very, very slow evolution over centuries. Diderot, the 18th century French. Did you notice how I keep talking about 18th century Frenchmen? What is that? I don't know. But anyway, Diderot was the head of something called the Encyclopedist Movement, that believed that all knowledge should be collected in encyclopedias. And he said, you know, that every year there's more and more knowledge to put into encyclopedias, and someday there'll be so much knowledge that an encyclopedia won't be able to hold it. And, you know, I don't know what we'll do then. That time came after World War II. Just tremendous amounts of information and science and technology and all sorts of things was developed during World War II. And a guy who worked for the U.S. government named Vannevar Bush in 1945, wrote an article for Atlantic called As We May Think. And all of the early developers of modern computers will tell you that they were extremely influenced by this article, As We May Think, in which he said, "Wholly new forms of encyclopedias will appear, ready-made with a mesh of associative trails running through them." That's what computers were about. Computers were never about novels. They were never about replacing paper. They were about a way of storing and accessing information. There was a growing need for this, and that's exactly what people worked on. People write books on computers and then publish them in paper, decrying the horrible thing that computers are doing to our civilization. And it's interesting to see how this was always said about new inventions. Plato was like that. You know, Plato was a guy who used the written word to write about how bad the written word was. This was a tremendous moment that doesn't really get studied enough when the world switched from oral languages to written languages. And Plato was very concerned about it. And his concerns sound very familiar today. I mean, he called writing artificial memory. And he said that, you know, some guy who just goes and looks things up in books doesn't have any real knowledge, which is, you know, exactly what I think when I'm in a conversation with somebody and they take out their iPhone and they Google something. It's like no real knowledge. Now, you know, we're being told that we're going to lose our memories. That's what they said would happen with the written word. A lot of people weren't happy about printed either. Printed texts were not carried in a lot of libraries because they weren't real, you know, they weren't handwritten. I have to admit I have a tendency to feel that way about things that are electronic instead of being on paper. I did a collection of short stories last year called City Beasts, and in the front of it I listed those stories that had been previously published in magazines. And I completely forgot the one that was published in an online magazine because in my mind it wasn't really published. It's a difference between me and my 15-year-old daughter. She thinks that electronic things are real. Kids shoot a lot of snapshots, and they have no interest in ever printing them or making copies of them. And I think, you know, you're going to lose your pictures if you just, you know, my daughter doesn't even back them up. Someday she's going to lose her iPhone and that'll be the end of her pictures. But they don't think like that. And, you know, that was what was happening when there was first printed books as opposed to handwritten. You know, it just isn't real. The debate about written language as opposed to oral language went on for years and years. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas said, "Jesus Christ never used written language." So, you know, we live in this world where things change and technologies serve these changes, and some of us always throw up our hands in horror about how this is destroying us, and we somehow get through it, you know. And everybody says, it's a changing world. I mean, how often do you hear that? It's a changing world. The world is really changing. Why do they say that? Was there ever a time in history when the world wasn't changing? You know, what's happening, what's different is that we have a lot more marketing now, you know. So you have, I mean, Apple comes up with a new iPhone every year, and they try to convince you that this is new technology. This leaves you with this feeling that, you know, there's the new technology coming at you every year, but it's not really new. They're just trying to get you to throw out your old phone and buy a new one, which people are doing less and less now, by the way. Apple's getting very concerned about that. You know, technology, inventors who invent technology, you know, without any concern about if anybody wants it, a lot of times that technology is doomed. Turns out we really didn't want supersonic jet transports. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when they're developing all these driverless cars. But I know a lot of people who really like to drive. And so I think, you know, there again, it'll be a case of technology giving you an alternative. That's, you know, that's what happens. E-books. When e-books first came out, a lot of people were saying, oh, this is the end of books. And people would say, you know, the e-book sales this year increased 100% over last year. You know, if you sold one e-book last year and two e-books this year, that's 100%. It stopped growing after it reached a certain point. It hasn't grown in years. Turns out some people like e-books, some people like hard books. Kids don't like e-books. Some people like e-books for traveling and hard books for when they're home, or they like certain kinds of books electronically and other books in hard books. And the point is that you have a choice. It's probably a good thing. But books aren't finished, and paper isn't finished. And it's my hope that if you read this book, that you will look at technology and history and look at our times a little differently. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's it for this broadcast of Speakers Forum. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.